Current state on 90.5 WKAR. So I'm lying in bed this morning after being awakened rudely by the storms that blew through mid-Michigan a few times very early this morning, and I'm laying there thinking, do these storms mean that the chance of violent weather at the Summer Solstice Jazz Festival this weekend is less? I'm preferring to think of it that way, okay? Always looking on the bright side. Join WKAR and jazz and music lovers from all over mid-Michigan this weekend, downtown Lansing. This is a great, great ritual to formally get summer started. The East Lansing Summer Solstice Jazz Festival. Be looking for WKAR there. 14 hours of great jazz. It's a free event. Saturday night, I'll be emceeing from the stage with Thornetta Davis and members of the MSU Jazz Studies Band. Orchestra Ritmo really lights up the stage on every Friday night, every year. And if you've been there, you know what I'm talking about. The formal beginning of summer is just about here. We hope you can join us this weekend in downtown East Lansing. Lot 1 is where you need to go. Hope you can make it. Wednesday means it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment here on Current State, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today we feature Kids Read Comics, a Michigan nonprofit that promotes comics for building youth engagement and creativity. This weekend marks their fifth annual Kids Read Comics celebration, which is being held at the Ann Arbor District Library. Dan Michigan is the co-founder of Kids Read Comics. He's a longtime comic book writer and co-creator of the superhero Blue Devil and the girls' fantasy adventure series Amethyst, Princess of Gem World at DC Comics. Dan, welcome to Current State.
Hi, thanks.
How did Kids Read Comics come to be?
Well, it came to be because several of us who are in different facets of the reading world, kids world, comics world, came together at a moment that really was propitious. I was in a period in my writing career where I discovered that the folks at DC and Marvel Comics didn't know how to sell comics to kids anymore for fascinating business reasons that a business reporter could ask me about sometime. But it was harder and harder to write comics for the people that I wanted to sell comics to or communicate with through comics. At around that time, a writer friend of mine started an event in New York called Kids Comic Con. That got me inspired. I talked about it with a friend of mine, a cartoonist named Jersey Drozd in Ann Arbor, who said, oh, it would be great to do something like that here. And he knew a librarian in Chelsea, teen and youth librarian, who was very into comics and had been wishing that she could do a comic book convention for kids. Mm-hmm. We brought in the owners of Green Brain Comics, a great comic book store in Dearborn, so that we'd have those different perspectives and started to think about what it would be like to really bring, you know, the love of comics and the ability to do something creative with comics for kids.
Now, Dan, you are a few decades north of your teen years.
I am.
Why did you hold on to this desire to communicate with younger people through your work rather than your peers?
Well, I think that part of it is that's when comics, at that age, was when comics really spoke to me with you know, great resonance. That the adventure stories I read, the superhero stories I read, my take on superheroes is that what they really are is an opportunity for kids to do a kind of rehearsal for adulthood. They read the stories about somebody with great power, and they begin to realize, you know, someday I'm going to have power in the world. I'm going to have to figure out how I'm going to use it. And that's the classic story that superhero comics told, but don't anymore because they can't reach the younger audience for those business reasons I was talking about. And I've always loved those stories, and I've always wanted to give that kind of experience to people who haven't had it.
There's something aspirational here then? Is that what you're saying? That kids respond to superheroes in a somewhat aspirational kind of way?
Right. I think it's below the surface. You know, I don't think they're saying, I'm coming here for this reason. They're coming for great pictures, the bright garishness of comic book art. And for the adventure and for the clever stories and all of that. But what they're finding, and a lot of the stories I write, are about characters who find something important that wasn't the thing they were looking for. What they find is a way of seeing the world and what they can do in the world. So aspirational in that sense. A kind of, I never want to write a story with a lesson, but I think any great story probably has one.
Mm. Does the process of reading a comic differ profoundly from that of reading a book?
I think it's similar in many ways, different in the sense that it requires an understanding of how words and pictures work together. Mm-hmm. A comic book writer and a comic book artist are collaborating. It's not like a children's book where you have a text that then has illustrations added to it. It's a way of telling a story through both pictures and words. One of the workshops that we've done is, what was it called, drawing narratively and writing, I can't remember, pictorially, something like that. So the idea is that the artist is telling a story and the writer is thinking in pictures, and then they work together. So as a reader, you have to pick up on what's going on. You have to pick up on the fact that any single panel of a comic book compresses the action into the moment that kind of contains all of the moments around it. I think the evidence that it's different from regular reading, the best evidence, is that there are so many adults who, if they didn't read comics when they were kids, don't know how to read comics.
Oh, interesting. Dan Mishkin's our guest here on Current State today. Dan's the co-founder of Kids Read Comics, and the annual Kids Read Comics event takes place this weekend at the Ann Arbor Public Library. Do you think kids have fewer opportunities to engage with comics today, or are they just not as popular? Or they're not being created. I guess that's part of your message.
Right. I think especially at the time that we started Kids Read Comics, there was a real dearth of comics that were even being made for kids. We discovered that we were coming along at a time when a whole lot of people had the same idea. They knew that DC Comics, Marvel Comics, the monthly comic books basically were not going to be reaching kids. But you started to see people doing comics online. They were doing their web comics. Sometimes those web comics became published books, but published not by comic book companies, published by trade book publishers like Scholastic and First Second, which is a division of Macmillan, and Abrams, the art book publisher. They have all come up with divisions that are devoted to doing comics, and often comics for young readers, but they were not around when we started Kids Read Comics.
You have used the word dearth and the word propitious so far, and you cannot use those words in your comic book work. We're glad to give you an opportunity to really dust off these 50-cent words on Current State, words that you probably can't use in the comic.
Well, you know, it's really important, and I think any writer, not only a comic book writer, has to know who your audience is. You have to speak in a way that particular audience is going to pick up on.
What kinds of kid-centric comics are out there today?
You know, there are great comics that are coming out in book form, and some from people who have been guests at our Kids Read Comics event or will be this weekend. We have had Raina Telgemeier, who has the wonderful book Smile, which is a memoir of her childhood, that was followed by drama, and she's got a new one coming out this fall called Sisters, which just are captivating books about her life experience told in the form of comics. Smile, I think, has been on the New York Times graphic novel bestseller list for 2 years now. So there are things like that. We have Frank Camuso, who has a new series of books about a young witch called The Misadventures of Salem Hyde. He's going to be at our event this weekend. There are really great things. Again, some of them are only web comics. There are people who are graphic artists during the day who want to do their wonderful web comic at night, and they do that.
Will this event run like other comic conventions and feature an artist alley?
Yes, we'll have a big artist alley. We have about 50 artists and writers, mostly from comics, some from animation and video games. But yes, they'll be there. And of course, it is all free. This is one of the great things. And we're so grateful to the Ann Arbor District Library, which puts in tremendous amount of work to make this happen. We'll have the artist alley on the first floor as people enter the library. And you'll just be able to go around and see what people are doing. And, you know, one of the things that we say to our artists who come to the show is that, yes, sure, we want you to sell your books. That's great. But our goal is not a commercial goal in the first place. It's about selling the love of comics, not selling the individual issues themselves. So they will, we really encourage them to engage people, sometimes even have, you know, a mini drawing workshop right at their table.
Let's talk about a few more of those workshops. Mini drawing workshop, mini comics, I understand.
Yeah, we have Matt Fiesel, who's an artist from Hamtramck, does a wonderful 90-minute workshop, how to make a mini comic. And you start out, the kids start out, and we're talking about kids who are probably so from 7 or 8 through early teens, and they're all sitting around a room, and Matt shows them what to do. They take a single sheet of 8.5 by 11 paper, and by the time they're finished 90 minutes later, they have folded it and cut and stapled so that they have an 8-page mini comic with a story that they've created right there during that workshop. And it's just wonderful. The pride that kids show in a comic that they've created is really tremendous to see. My theory about kids making comics is that kids who are inhibited about writing and kids who are inhibited about drawing somehow short-circuit those inhibitions when they have to do both at the same time. And so they just do comics. And doing comics is great.
Interesting. We're talking about the 5th annual Kids Read Comics Celebration taking place this weekend at the Ann Arbor District Library. Our guest is organizer Dan Mishkin. What's the turnout been like at your previous events?
You know, it's hard to tell exactly what our numbers are because we don't charge admission and because people are coming into the library for other things. But we felt last year like we had a minimum of 1,500 people who were really going there seeing part of our show.
Wow.
And, you know, we hope to get those numbers up. We were actually on the 3rd floor of the library last year, 1st floor this year, and that might encourage more people who didn't know what was going on to start to get involved.
Are there children artists that are involved in the artist alleyway?
Yeah, the youngest artist that we've had exhibit at Kids Read Comics was an 8-year-old. And we had her come because the previous year, she started talking to one of our tabling artists about what she needed to do to become an artist, to become a real artist. And she showed him the things that he had done. And he said to her, you know, you're already a real cartoonist. The only difference between you and me is which side of the table we're sitting on, which is what a wonderful thing to say to a kid. And the next year, she was there with the photocopied, stapled together comics that she had been charging her mother 25 cents for. She started charging 25 cents for people who came up, and a lot of people bought them. And you know what? When an artist alleys, artists will trade their comics. Yeah, oh, you give me yours, I'll give you mine. There were artists who had their $3 or $4 or $5 or $10 comics, and they would trade for her 25-cent photocopied comic because they treated her as a peer. What a great experience for a kid.
How is Kids Read Comics underwritten? How do you fund this effort?
Really, it's the Ann Arbor District Library that carries the lion's share of the expenses. We have a little bit of money. We, unfortunately, because it's a totally volunteer organization, haven't gotten our 501c3 federal tax-exempt designation yet. So we have very little money to spend. But Ann Arbor, you know, oh gosh, they do great things. They devoting the space, organizing it, advertising, printing up our program booklet, and just making everything, and feeding our guests. They feed lunch to our 50 guests every day.
If people want to lend you a hand in this effort, how do they do that?
Well, I think the best thing for them to do is to check our website at kidsreadcomics.org. That will contain ways of contacting us, kidsreadcomics@gmail.com. Allows them to reach us. And, you know, if they, I won't give advice on tax law, but if they want to give us money, you know, one of the things that I would really like to do that we haven't been able to do yet is to bring in more kids from farther away than Ann Arbor, inner city kids who might benefit from taking part in our show and, you know, having buses or vans or whatever. That's the first place I would put money that comes into Kids Read Comics.
Dan Mishkins, the co-founder of Kids Read Comics. The annual Kids Read Comics event takes place this weekend at the Ann Arbor Public Library. Dan, good luck. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. If you've already tired of this year's summer hits, Current State's Emmanuel Berry has some alternative tunes from Korea for you. So, Emmanuel, why Korea?
Well, if you're tired of summer offerings like Iggy Azalea or Turn Down for What, I mean, I don't know if I can hear these one more time before I just give up on music altogether. So for my own musical salvation, I turned to my friend Elise Yoon, who hosts the Asian Invasion on Impact 89 FM. It's an Asian music show, and on it she plays a lot of K-pop or Korean popular music. So since I know virtually nothing about K-pop, Elise started with the very basics.
All right, Elise, let's start with the basics. What is K-pop and how did you become interested in it?
So K-pop means Korean popular music. I originally started getting into this. I heard little bits of it during my childhood, but I didn't really get into it until I went to study abroad in Korea, which is a place where you cannot escape K-pop. And it's really catchy. It's a lot of fun. It's got lots of energy and many different genres.
So you currently host an Asian music show at the student radio station Impact 89 FM. Tell us a little bit about that show and how you became involved.
So I've been working at the Impact for a while now, and then about 4.5 years ago, 2010, I started the Asian Invasion, which is our resident Asian music program. We play K-pop, we play indie music, we play J-pop, we play rock, hip-hop, anything I can get a hold of that I think will be interesting and fun for the listeners. And fun for myself as well.
So with K-pop, is it just popular in Korea? I mean, is your show really a niche show, or is it something that people all over the world are listening to?
It's definitely really popular in Korea, obviously, Korean popular music. But in recent years, it's gotten huge all around the world. China, Japan, all of Asia, Southeast Asia. There's K-pop stars singing in Mandarin Chinese, they're singing in Japanese, they're singing in English, they're learning all sorts of languages to reach out to their audiences all around the world. You know, there's K-pop fans in Saudi Arabia, there's K-pop fans in Russia, South America, and K-pop artists have even traveled and done arena concerts in South America and Europe.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I would not think that.
Even here in America, they've come and done big shows here in America.
When you say the word K-pop, I think I kind of get stuck on the word pop, or that genre of pop music. Mm-hmm. Is it just pop music, or is it a broader term?
Yeah, so the term K-pop is kind of misleading. It's very encompassing. It's very broad. There's rap, there's hip-hop, there's ballads, there's, of course, your traditional dance and R&B songs. You even have country-inspired K-pop songs, which I think is really fun and interesting. But yeah, the term K-pop, it can be kind of misleading because you just think of pop music, but it's a very, very broad term.
Okay, so K-pop newbie. There are hundreds of different songs, hundreds and thousands of different songs that we're dealing with here. Too many artists. I don't speak Korean. Where do I even start?
Where do you start when you want to listen to K-pop? I would recommend some of my favorite artists, starting with 21. They are excellent. They are a very fierce group of four girls. And they actually originally started to be the female counterpart of Big Bang, which is a big male group. But since then, they've really taken on their own identity. They are the biggest band in the world. They actually won MTV Iggy's Biggest Band in the World, or Best Band in the World. They've toured in America once, and they're currently on their second world tour right now. So 21 has this very fun style. They combine pop, they combine ballads and dance songs, but they have this really unique way of infusing hip-hop into their songs. And you can really hear this in one of their songs. It's from their most recent album, which is called Crush, and the song is called Come Back Home. Come back home. Can you come back home? Yeah. 차가운 세상 끝에 날 버리지 말고 내 곁으로 come back home. Can you come back home? Yeah. 모든 아픔은 뒤로 해. 여전히 널 기다려 이렇게 해. Now you gotta do what you gotta do. Come back home.
That was 21, or to anyone. So it's the number 2 and then the letters N-E and 1 is how it would be typed out.
Yeah, it's kind of a play on words, like 21 or to anyone.
Mm-hmm. And that was their song, Come Back Home. Let's talk a little bit about Korean rap, and one of the most, I guess, influential or famous Korean rappers would be G-Dragon. Tell me about G-Dragon.
Oh, G-Dragon. I love him. He's extremely talented. He's actually been in the K-pop industry, most people don't know this, from when he was a really young child. One of his friend's parents was working in the industry, and he is just a musical genius. He's been writing lyrics and music for hip-hop songs and K-pop songs since he was, you know, a tiny little kid still in school. And now he continues to produce, write, and write lyrics and music for himself, for Big Bang, and for groups like 21 and other YG Entertainment artists.
So if we're going to listen to a G-Dragon song to get us understanding his type of music, what do you recommend?
Definitely his song, One of a Kind. I think that lyric, that "Yes, sir, I'm one of a kind," it sums it all up. He's completely unique, and he's a completely unique force in the world of K-pop. He definitely has his own brand of swag. I kind of hate to use that word because of Justin Bieber, but before that word...
Before Justin Bieber had swag...
G-Dragon. Absolutely. He was the definition of swag. He's got lots of energy. He can sing. He can rap. He has this kind of unique way of rapping. It's almost like a little bit defiant. It's kind of funny, and it's a lot of fun to listen to.
So this is G-Dragon. The track is called One of a Kind.
Yes, sir. One of a kind. Just wanna know. Don't be some of it.
That was G-Dragon, the Korean artist, with his song One of a Kind. So at least we've heard from 21 and G-Dragon, very big, popular, mainstream Korean pop. What's something a little more underground, a little less mainstream in the K-pop realm?
Recently, one of my favorite artists have been Geeks. Not to be confused with The Geeks, which is a punk band, but Geeks. They're a hip-hop duo made up of Louis and Lil Boy. And as solo artists, their music is not so mainstream. They're kind of more hardcore rap. But together, they combine like this pop appeal with their hip-hop skills, and they make these really fun, kind of light hip-hop pop songs. So they're really good at integrating their hardcore rap skills with this pop appeal, and at the same time making every girl's hearts flutter. These songs are just, they're a lot of fun. They're really cute songs.
So we're going to play one of their songs, a little bit of one of their songs. This is Fly by the duo Geeks.
I just need your love, love I feel you in.
That was the track Fly by the Korean rap duo Geeks. And speaking with Elise Yoon, she's the host of the Impact Asian Music Show. We're talking K-pop or Korean popular music and where to start if you want to get into it. As you mentioned earlier, you were talking about how K-pop is really global. People are singing in different languages. There are people in the K-pop industry who are not from Korea or born in Korea. Tell me a little bit about the Korean-American star A-Lee.
She is wonderful. She has the most powerful, beautiful voice, and she actually grew up on the East Coast of America. That's where she grew up, and then she decided to move to Korea to pursue her singing career, which I'm really happy about. I'm sure all of Korea is really happy about. She had a really kind of unprecedented debut. Most K-pop stars, they'll debut, and, you know, it's okay. People notice sometimes. There's tons and tons of K-pop artists debuting every single week, so it's a big market, and it's kind of a hard market to get into.
Mm-hmm.
But she was working with the veteran K-pop star Hwiseong, and he actually wrote and produced her song Heaven, which is just a beautiful song no matter who's singing it, but she also has this very powerful voice, which worked so perfectly well for the song. I think Hwiseong recognized this and really took advantage of that. So when she debuted, her song was at number one for weeks and weeks and weeks, which is just completely unprecedented for any K-pop artist, especially a rookie artist.
You're my only one way. Thank you.
So we've listened to a lot of great songs, Elise, but I still need to ask, why should people give K-pop a chance? It would seem like it's a different language. You know, we already have so much saturation in the U.S. market. Why listen to K-pop?
Geez, there's so many reasons. K-pop's just a lot of fun. To me, it was just so refreshing to hear something different. And it's not too different from American pop, actually. It takes lots of its cues visually, stylistically, sonically from American pop. You know, Korea has always been very influenced by American popular culture because of our historical, political, military ties and all that. But to me, K-pop is just something fresh. It's different. It's a lot of fun. And it combines this very new kind of different, unique energy from Korea with the style of traditional pop music. And they're doing some different things as well, like combining ballads with rap songs. And I think this is something that K-pop nails absolutely. They just do it seamlessly.
So if we're to go out on a track, any recommendations? What do we want to go out with?
One of my favorite all-time K-pop songs, just because it's so much fun, is Brown Eyed Girl's Abracadabra. It's just, you will immediately start dancing to this song as soon as you hear it. It's kind of hard not to dance to it.
Well, Elise, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for your recommendations.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Hope you enjoy K-pop.
Elise Yoon is the host of the Impact's Asian Music Show.
The sound of trains can be commonly heard in Owosso this weekend. Steam whistles will be added to the clickety-clack of steel wheels during the Steam Railroading Institute's Train Expo, and current state Scott Pohl went to Owosso for a preview. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark. One of Owosso's claims to fame is that it's home to the 1225 locomotive used as the model for the film version of the Polar Express. But that's just a small fraction of what's here for the train enthusiast. We've posted some fun pictures in a slideshow at WKAR.org. Have a look today. Along with the steam engines, the Train Expo goes further, though, with events related to cars and airplanes, too. Terry Bush is event coordinator for the Steam Railroading Institute. We started our talk about the Train Expo with a look at the airplanes before we got to the stuff about trains.
The Owosso Community Airport will be hosting the Yankee Air Museum, and they will have their B-17 and B-25 on board for flights. They will be giving flights when they have a full complement of passengers, and they will be on display during the event. These are authentic airplanes that you just don't see every day. As well, the Tuskegee Airmen are bringing the P-51 Mustang. That's another very cool plane from the World War II era that will be on board, as well as the Tuskegee Glider Club will be here with some gliders. There's going to be other planes on board and rides available, ranging from as little as $50-$60 up to $450 if you want to ride in the nose cone of a B-17, which, you know, it sounds like a very exciting experience as well. We also have the Misty Blues Lady Skydiving Team that will be here. They'll be jumping twice a day, Saturday and Sunday. That's very exciting. They will take off from the airport and land right here on the grounds.
Now, I think it's pretty widely known that the train that people saw in the film version of Polar Express is here. But for the benefit of people who weren't aware of that, tell me more about that, how that came to be, and what that has meant to the Steam Railroading Institute here in Owosso.
It's huge for us. It's given us a window into bringing young people into the fold of steam power. It's that connection. It allows grandparents and grandchildren to come together and come experience something together through our North Pole Express experience. It's something great for both of them. And we're creating the next generation of steam enthusiasts. So we know we're all about education. And this train really, it makes it easy to bring on board the young people through education and the love of the North Pole Express.
We had you climb up on it to take a photo for our website, and you really seem to get a kick out of doing that.
I get so excited to get to be near that locomotive. You know, I'm a front office person. I don't get that experience every day, so it's always a big kick to be able to step into the cab, which I've only done once, and now to sit on the front, which you made possible for me. Thank you very much.
I'm really happy to accommodate you.
I appreciate that.
There are train rides during the festival, too. Some are 1 hour, some are longer. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about that?
Yes, the 1 hour trains will run four times a day, 10, 12, 2, and 4, and they will feature a train robbery. So watch your wallet. We had great luck and a great reception with our train robberies in the past. We did them last year. So we've even stepped it up a notch. It's going to be a real exciting experience for people riding the train to have a great steam train ride and experience cowboy robbery for themselves. Now, if you want to step it up a notch and you're a real train enthusiast, you can take our half-day excursion, which goes to Alma and back. It doesn't stop. It just goes to Alma and back because we need to have our trains on site as much as possible. And they will have many different classes, so you can ride in an open-air car, in a coach car. You can ride in a dome-class car and have a 360-degree view with an elegant meal. So we have the range of experiences.
What's the cars part of the program this year?
Well, we are having, there's a lot of car shows around. That's a very common thing in our state. But I have cars coming that are really special. The Gilmore Museum is providing some cars. I have a Duesenberg coming. I have an Auburn coming. I have some really special cars. And it will be held at the Auto Diesel Institute of Baker College, which is a brand new facility, which is a beautiful place and a really nice setting for this car show. We're going to have a car cruise. We're going to cruise the area with these beautiful cars. And then Saturday and Sunday, that'll be Friday night, and Saturday and Sunday will be car shows. So we're going to have a lot of beautiful cars and a plethora of horsepower. From one horsepower from the DeVries Nature Center's carriage to 6,000 horsepower, the 1225.
One of the things that caught my eye is a train made out of Legos.
Yes, we're really excited about the Lego display. This will be a unique presentation. It's going to represent buildings from Michigan, different buildings from Michigan, as well as locomotives. It's almost 400 square feet and 13 feet tall. It'll be inside our museum. We're really excited about that. It will feature all the characters from the Lego movie somewhere in the set, so that's something for the kids to look for. Those characters, they will all be there.
30,000 people or so? I assume that there are locals who come every year, but you get visitors from all over.
We do. We get visitors from all over the world, especially in the summertime, but year-round. And it's so amazing and cool that people will come in from Japan, from China, Australia, Europe, Canada, South America. They come because it's a rare commodity to have to see a steam locomotive, and they make sure to put us on their agenda. Yes, that's awesome. But this particular event will bring people from all over the world, locals, regional, everyone will come together for this event.
Now, when the people who made Polar Express came here to look at the locomotive for ideas, they spotted someone here who they liked the look of so much, they wound up modeling a character after him.
That's true. Kevin Mayer, who's our Chief Mechanical Officer, Director of Operations, he's very knowledgeable, and for some reason, his character, his smile, his demeanor is so captivating that they felt that they wanted to create a character around him, and therefore he became the engineer on the 1225 train for the movie.
Well, let's talk with him, too.
I'm Kevin Mayer. I am the Director of Operations and Chief Mechanical Officer for the Steam Railroading Institute.
Do people who've seen Polar Express recognize you when they see you?
No. Well, they do when I have my head shaved.
Oh.
And I don't have my hat on, so.
Are you going to shave your head?
No.
Was it fun when the Hollywood types were around here?
We talked to most of the Hollywood types who are on the phone. The only ones that we really worked with on a face-to-face value was George Lucas's team, who was up here, did the sounds and stuff, and that was pretty cool and neat to actually do. And my wife cannot stand to watch the movie with me, and actually nobody can, because I can tell them exactly how each sound was made. I can tell them what it is, how they created that sound, and
you can tell them what they got wrong too.
Yeah. So they didn't get much wrong on it, so they got some little bit here and there, but they got for the most part with the sounds and stuff pretty good, close. So
as you prepare for 3 days of visitors, more than normal, I guess, would be the way to put it. What are you doing to help prepare for that?
My job is actually, for the most part, for the train venue. I'll be the one in charge of bringing the trains in, getting the trains out for the train rides, putting trains up for display. And on top of that, I make sure all the venues and everything mechanically goes without a hitch.
This is a big deal. Lots of people visit Owosso. Lots of people, it might be the only time they ever come to Owosso. And so it's really important to this community that this event come off without a hitch.
Yeah, it's not just a national thing. It's actually a worldwide. We have actually tickets purchased from England, France, China, Indonesia, I mean, just Australia, from all over the country, or all over the world. To come just for this event, to ride behind the steam locomotives, to see these steam locomotives up close, be able to get up in the cabs of these locomotives. We do offer you, actually, for the little tank engines, you can run them. So there's always a lot going on with that. So, and it's not something for just adults. There's all kinds of kids stuff going on. We have a midway. We also have an entertainment tent where we have children book readings from award-winning authors, high school jazz bands. So there's stuff for everybody that's going to be going on.
Why do you love trains?
I've always been fascinated with them. 1225 in particular, because when I was 12 years old, it's where they did the test runs right next to my house. So I remember it from when they first actually got it running and doing their test runs. I actually, once I got involved with this place, that's when I went and got a job with the regular railroads, and then ultimately working here.
Did you grow up in Owosso then?
Yes, I'm born and raised in Owosso.
So you're able to devote your life to a passion. That's what we all aspire to in our lives.
Yep. I actually get to get paid to do my hobby. So,
and it's fun to show things off during this festival.
Oh, yeah. Show things off and educate people. My big thing is I like teaching young people of what this stuff's all about, safety reasons, other reasons, where we come from, how we got to where we are today. Get more younger people involved. We have an Explorers Post 1225. They're actually just starting now the restoration of another steam locomotive on site here. That's open to all boys and girls from the ages of 15 to 21. So my big thing is to educate, to show young people what it's all about. We have a machine shop in our shop with old machinery that it's a lost art, but it teaches young people and older people the basic skills that you need to make it in a manufacturer's business, where they can actually, if they know these skills, they'd be able to go above and beyond just going into a manufacturing and pushing a button. They'd actually be able to make parts without computers and know how to read a tape measure, not use a calculator and stuff like that.
This is a three-day event. What are you working on the other 360-plus days of the year? What kind of work do you do the rest of the season?
The work we do, we maintain our car fleet. We restore our cars. Of course, 1225, when it's not running, we are always, it's over almost 80 years old. It always needs constant work. We work with the Explorers, rebuilding another steam locomotive. And we do some contract work where other museums and stuff come in and ask us to work on their equipment. And then we show open to the public and stuff and show off what we can get. Of course, with 1225, we're running trips during the winter. We do train rides during the summer. So there's always something going on.
Well, you seem to really love your job.
Yes, I do.
The Steam Railroading Institute of Owosso's Train Expo 2014, called Locomotives, Wings, and Wheels, takes place June 20th through the 22nd in Owosso. From Owosso, I'm Scott Pohl for Current State.
One year ago today, the American Medical Association made news when it said that obesity should be considered a disease. Many obesity experts have welcomed the redesignation. They say it will spur more people to get medical attention and treatment. That's important because overweight and obese people commonly contract serious health problems like heart disease and diabetes. But the move has generated skepticism as well. Doubters say that medicalizing obesity could lead too many people to drugs and surgery and away from critical lifestyle changes. Count our next guest among the supporters of the move. Tommy Thompson served 14 years as the governor of Wisconsin and as U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services in the George W. Bush administration. He visits Lansing today in his current role as the independent chair of the Deloitte Center for Healthcare Management and Transformation and will speak inside the Speaker's Library at the State Capitol today at 1 p.m. Governor Thompson, welcome back to Michigan.
Well, it's always an honor to be in Michigan, Mark, and you have a great day. Sorry about the thunderstorms, but in spite of that, it's a beautiful day in Michigan and a beautiful opportunity to get our message out.
Well, we're appreciative of the chance to talk with you. You have supported this redesignation by the AMA. Why?
Well, first off, it's been a year since the American Medical Association has designated obesity as a disease. And the reason is quite simple. Obesity is causing huge problems in chronic illnesses, which make up about 75% of the cost of health care spend in America, and about 70% of the deaths are caused indirectly or directly by chronic illnesses, and one of the biggest reasons is obesity. And the cost of obesity to American taxpayers and to the cost of the healthcare system is about $200 billion. It's about $3 billion in the state of Michigan. So it's a huge dollar cost, it's a huge lifestyle cost, and more importantly, it's causing the medical system and the healthcare system to almost be collapsing because of the cost of healthcare of chronic illnesses. And we have to do something about wellness and prevention, and that's why I'm carrying the message that the American Medical Association has instituted about a year ago.
But what did it change? What did the redesignation change a year ago?
Well, what it really said is that that obesity is a disease, and that means that people can more openly talk about a classification of a disease such as obesity. And it also means that we have a better shot and chance of getting Medicare to cover obesity as a disease and be able to allow doctors to treat for that by prescribing medicines. There's a proposal in Congress with 100 co-sponsors, two of which are from Michigan, one Democrat and one Republican, that are trying to get the Treat and Reduce Obesity Act through Congress. And this would allow Medicare to cover the medicines to treat obesity. And up until now, Medicare cannot treat obesity with the pay and reimbursing for medicines. And that causes a huge problem for a doctor because a lot of people, and you've said it, Mark, a lot of people, you know, are critical and say, you know, you can make a lifestyle change. It's your fault that you're fat. And, you know, go out and exercise and don't eat so much. But some people, even if they exercise and eat properly, are still going to have a weight problem. And for those individuals, it's important for doctors to be able to prescribe medicines for them.
Governor Tommy Thompson is our guest here. We're talking about the one-year anniversary of the American Medical Association redesignating obesity as a disease. Previously, it's been referred to as a major lifestyle problem or words to that effect. What have you seen in the past year, Governor? Did policymakers increasingly take note of this redesignation as you and others had hoped?
There's much more talk about it, and I don't know if it's the designation, the fact of the Affordable Care Act, the who some people refer to as the Obamacare Act, or what. But people are becoming much more interested in the healthcare system, and indirectly, or possibly directly, are more interested in their own personal health. And as a result of that, obesity is becoming much more of a subject, much more front and center. And that's allowing doctors, you know, to become much more involved in prescribing medicines, even though they may not be reimbursed, and be able to do surgeries and other type of things that people probably would have frowned upon before this.
Work done at the University of Minnesota that was written up in the New York Times earlier this year indicated that there is a negative impact for some obese people to be diagnosed with a disease. And I'll quote from the article here, quote,
okay.
Suggesting that one's weight is a fixed state, like a long-term disease, made attempts at weight management seem futile and thus undermined the importance that obese individuals placed on health-focused dieting and concern for weight, unquote. Do you fear that if obesity is increasingly considered a disease, that more people are apt not to take adequate measures of their own?
No, I don't. I think it's a combination of a lot of things, Mark. You know, first off, it's education. We have to talk in our schools, as we've got to start at an earlier age than we have before, about wellness and prevention. That's number one. Number two, we got to talk about the problems with being overweight and obese. And it's a growing problem in America, no pun intended. And we have to get more people involved in it. And I know that there are these kind of studies out there, but 100 congressmen have signed on the legislation, Democrats and Republicans, on a bipartisan basis, to be able to pass into law a proposal to treat obesity as a disease. And that is an indication that it's not some faraway study that some people is looking at that thinks that it may be a problem to have obesity be considered a disease. We have to recognize obesity is a disease. And when you look at the cost, $200 billion just on obesity, and 75% of the cost of the whole healthcare system, which is $2.7 trillion, is caused by chronic illnesses, and obesity is really one of the fundamental causes of chronic illnesses, we have to recognize that the whole healthcare system has the potential for collapsing under the strain of expenses if, in fact, we don't start treating these diseases. I can remember back before Part D was passed, and I was responsible for getting that passed, Mark, when I was secretary, and seniors were not being able to get the medicines necessary, and sometimes they went without or went without other things in order to get the money for their medicines. And since we passed Part D, we have been able to see a much better and a healthier senior element because of the medicine under Part D. And we also used to, in America, not allow for the reimbursement of medicines for high blood pressure and heart diseases, and that has been changed. And we would pay for open-heart surgery, but not for the medicines that would prevent open-heart surgery. So it's a complicated subject, but I'm here to say that I really believe that obesity is a disease and we have to treat it as such, and therefore we have to pass the law in order for reimbursement of medicines.
Now, if the designation of obesity as a disease requires a range of medical interventions for treatment, those are
right.
the exact words here from the AMA, the insurance industry must have a position on this. Where does the health insurance industry stand on this redesignation?
Well, you're going to find that it's not unanimous, but most individuals that are looking at the insurance industry recognize that it's a cost saver, that if you treat obesity and reimburse for medical interventions, you're going to save in the long run. And it's just obvious. Obesity is causing $200 billion, and it's growing each year. And if you treat it and you're able to reduce it, you're going to save money for the patient, for the taxpayers, and yes, for the insurance company. So if you look at it in a practical, common sense way, you will find that if you treat it, you're going to be able to save money for all of these elements, the taxpayer, the individual and the insurance industry, the payers.
Governor Tommy Thompson is our guest here today on Current State. A couple of political questions, if you don't mind. You remember politics, right?
Oh, I certainly do.
Yeah.
It's never far away from me, but thank you for bringing that up, Mark.
Well, Tea Party-backed Republicans continue to win primaries over incumbents. It happened again last week in Virginia. Were reports of the Tea Party's demise premature?
Oh, I think the Tea Party is always going to play an active role. I don't know if you can classify being very conservative and concerned about your government as always being a Tea Party. I think the Tea Party category is very broad, and there's going to be individuals that believe that government spends too much and is too large, and I think they're going to be playing an impact. But I really sincerely think that the Eric Cantor defeat was much more a local issue. Lyndon Johnson said it best, all politics is local. And Eric Cantor did not spend enough time in his district, was all over the country raising money for candidates. And I know full well that whether you're a governor, whether you're a state legislator, or a congressman, or a U.S. senator, if you don't take care of the home people, and if they think that you're not paying attention to them, you got problems.
And
that was the problem Eric Cantor had, not conservative enough was not his problem.
And just time for a brief answer on this, Governor, do you think your party will retake the Senate this year?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any question that we will.
Very good. Governor Tommy Thompson in Lansing today to talk about action on health care across and obesity here in America. Governor Thompson, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Mark. You're a great interviewer. It's my pleasure to be on your program. Thank you.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll learn about the rebuilding of Patriarch Park in East Lansing, and we'll hear from a band honoring avant-garde jazz artist Sun Ra. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.